From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, you can call us right now at 800-462-7413. And Zorba, along with our wonderful callers, we have some interesting topics to talk about.
Cracking your knuckles. What really happens? I know, Tom, that's been on your mind for years. Something that you've been thinking about over and over and over again.
Actually,
right?
I think I know, but I'll find out more from you.
Yeah, you will.
And?
Aspirin reduces some forms of cancer. Information from the Nurses' Health Study, the Physicians' Health Study, that may change your mind about aspirin if you are not taking it.
Mm-hmm. And our recipe?
Crispy sesame pork. It is delicious if you like pork.
Which I do. Mm-hmm. 800-462-7413, our number. And Zorba, our first caller is a listener in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
I have a pain that is underneath my lower right rib. This has been going on for over a year and a half. Uh-huh. And it seems to be, it might be an intestinal thing. I don't know anymore.
Uh-huh. Why do you think it's an intestinal thing?
Well, there's a lot of weird connected symptoms that don't make any sense.
Yeah. Can I ask, is it painful kind of all the time under the rib?
It quiets down at night, starting at about 10 o'clock, and then during the day it can be real bad. It's a gnawing, like fire-like pain.
Oh, man, does it hurt when you touch it?
No. No, it's inside.
You think it's intestinal because you have gas that passes, or you're just your, I mean, I hear rumbling in my stomach, but it doesn't hurt. Why do you have a connection there?
If I have passed a little bit of gas, mm-hmm. the pain will shoot all the way up into my upper right quadrant.
Uh-huh. It sounds like it might be gas. You constipated?
Well, since you talked me out of my healthy gallbladder, I tend to go in that direction now.
Oh, so you had your gallbladder removed. Okay,
that's part of it. It took them a year to convince mm-hmm. me to have it removed, and then after it was removed, they're like, after that, things went from bad to worse.
Oh, I see. You mean they kept on saying for the year, take out the gallbladder, take out the gallbladder, take out the gallbladder, and you said no, 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 and then you finally gave in?
Yeah.
Oh, and that was a mistake, huh?
Yeah, well, last year I cried every single day. Oh. And, you know, it was very, very difficult. I'm in a little bit better place now. Mm-hmm. You know, but the thing is I go to the doctor and you're sitting in their office crying while they're sending you a psychiatrist, you know.
Oh, no, that's a serious thing. We have to take, you know, emotion seriously. I want to go to that part for just a minute. Were you upset with the surgery? Were you that upset, or was it the pain? What was behind, you know, your distress, your mental distress?
I was upset about going from, you know, pain levels of 4 or 5 to a 10.
Oh, okay.
And not being able to sleep at night anymore. Uh-huh. And, I mean, that lasted most of the year.
Oh, okay.
And and now we've gotten into mastering the art of making bone broth and treating for something called leaky gut syndrome.
Uh-huh. Let me go back to the intestinal thing. Are you constipated?
I go every day.
So how would you describe your poop?
I have great stools.
Okay.
Everything I do is about producing great stools.
Okay. So that's okay. Tom really got excited by that. It really turned him on.
Hey, you got to have a cause.
No, but we kid you not, they're really very, very important. Have you ever taken Metamucil?
Yeah, I have tried it. Yeah.
I highly recommend a trial of Metamucil. Now, Metamucil is made from psyllium seeds. It is a bulk former. It may be a bulk former laxative, but it does amazing things with the gut. We in America are the largest consumers of Metamucil in the world. I don't know what that says about our diet, but it means we eat a lot of refined sugars and so on. It means our diet really isn't very good. But Metamucil is an incredible thing to use because it is not absorbed. What you do is you take a scoop at least once a day. In the morning, I recommend with a full glass of something. You know, you can get orange flavored, you can get plain and put it in juice. But as soon as it's in the glass, you swirl it around and drink it right down. If you leave it in the glass, it looks like Jell-O and it doesn't taste good. It is gritty. So when you're all done, you'll feel like you drank some sand, and then you followed that with some water to get rid of that gritty taste. It will change your life. And the reason is it adds a regular amount of bulk into your stool. And even though you've got a good stool, I think Metamucil is awesome. Makes a huge difference. And it may make a huge difference with your pain, because Metamucil with people post-gallbladder can really make a difference with the pain and discomfort, because it normalizes your bowel. So that's my recommendation. Try that. And I would try it for 2 to 4 weeks every day. Do not try it occasionally. You've got to have a regular Metamucil, you know, if you will, drink in the morning. A shot of Metamucil in the morning can make a big difference.
Okay, yeah, I'll try anything at this point. So.
I would try that. And then keep up with the other stuff that you're doing. You know, the bone broth and other things. Don't give that up. Keep it up, but add Metamucil to the regime and let us know. I am a great proponent of Metamucil. And by the way, full disclosure, I don't own any stock in the company.
Okay.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for your call. Thanks for sharing that with us. Appreciate it.
And good luck to you. 800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And Zorba, let's welcome a listener now in Appleton, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, Dr. Zorba and Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's up?
My question today is in regards to rheumatoid arthritis and treating it with medication versus a different approach such as massage therapy or chiropractic care. I'm 35 years old, and when I was 26, I started feeling symptoms of rheumatoid arthritis. I've had stiffness primarily in my left foot and in my right hand. I was tested, and my levels would fluctuate, so the specialist I was seeing at the time was just giving me prednisone during flare-ups, and over the course of the years, I would just sort of treat it with my diet, and by staying active. About 2 to 3 years ago, I noticed my flare-ups were lasting longer, and they were coming on more frequently. It would take me about 30 minutes in the morning just to sort of feel like I could get going. And so I went to a specialist again, and they put me on prednisone to help with the swelling, which it did. And then we started a course of methotrexate. We tried a couple different medications to go along with the methotrexate, and I would either be nauseous or the prices were too high. Mm-hmm. He recently tried me on a medication called leflumonide, and I was a little concerned with taking it just because of the warnings.
Oh, sure. But I want to go back to the chiropractic for just a second and massage therapy. Those are very good non-pharmacological ways to treat pain and discomfort. And I don't look at it as A or B. I look at it as A and B. So I would use all the non-pharmacological ways, you know, of treating you. And then the question is, when do you step in with pharmacology? And I don't think there's any evidence that chiropractic, reflexology, and massage stop the continuous, unrelenting progress of rheumatoid arthritis. So I'm on the side of the rheumatologist in that the biologicals, which are extremely expensive, are altering diseases. You're not treating pain. You're treating, if you will, the basis of the inflammation of the joint. So I think your rheumatologist is saying, hey, this is not altering the progression of the disease. You then have to decide what you want. In other words, on one hand, I have a good chance of altering the progression. I can't tell for sure. But these drugs are really expensive and they have side effects. And on the other hand, I don't want my disease to progress. And you've got to make a decision. I mean, you have to decide what you want to do. These drugs have been out for about 20 years, and they have changed rheumatoid arthritis, and they are expensive.
Is it a given that it will progress, get worse over time without the—
Most people progress over time. Is it a given? Most do. Not everyone does. So that's the answer. You know, is it going to be you? You know, is it going to be you or something else? Now, when you say expensive, biologicals are expensive. Do you have insurance?
I do, and I did look at that.
Yeah.
My insurance.
Yeah, what's the cost for your insurance?
the cost for a 90-day supply was going to be about $1,500.
Okay, $1,500. What about the other biologicals? Were the other biologicals that expensive?
I haven't looked at all of those. Okay.
So what you want to do is you want to look at the biological that's covered by your insurance. Because $1,500, you know, which is $6,000 a year, is very expensive. But your insurance may cover, they contract with another company, it might only cost you $500 to $1,000. Now, that's a lot of money. But you've got to look at it within the realm of technology. We buy an automobile. We get our car fixed. When I get new tires for my car, what does it cost? How much does it cost? I had a fractured ankle and I had surgery in my ankle. You've got to look at it within the cost of what we pay in society. But you want to get the one that's covered by your insurance. That's what you want to do. And I think the biologicals have made a difference in rheumatoid arthritis. I'm squarely on that side. So that's.
And my rheumatologist had said that. He just said we had to try all the all the other medications first to go along with methotrexate.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that leflunomide made me just a little nervous.
I think you're right to be nervous. And you've got that on one hand. These are the side effects. There are dangers. It's a real problem. These are the side effects of not taking the drug. There are dangers. They have a problem. And then you kind of decide that together. And we do that all the time. Middle of the winter time, if there's ice on the street and it's an ice storm, I don't go outside unless I really have to. But if there's little snow on the street, well, I'll go down my driveway. It'll be fine. So I'm making a risk evaluation as to what I'm doing, and that's what you have to do with your body. Good luck.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Appreciate that call. Thanks so much. And now, Zorba, let's crack our knuckles.
That's right. This has been on everyone's mind. I know that.
Deal with the really serious medical
issues. That's right. That's right. The importance of what's going on when you're cracking your knuckles. Now, first of all, what did your mother say? Did you crack your knuckles?
No.
Well, let's pretend you cracked your knuckles. What do you think your mother would say?
Don't crack your knuckles.
Don't crack your knuckles.
Yeah.
That's right. Now, why is cracking your knuckles so unpleasant for adults?
I think that it would somehow or other hurt your knuckles in the long run.
It doesn't bother other kids. You know, if you're in middle school and you crack your knuckles. Let's ask Carl. Carl, did you crack your knuckles as a kid? Yes, he did. Was your mother upset when you cracked your knuckles? No. His mother was not upset. How about the lofty engineer? Did our engineer, he cracked his knuckles.
Brad.
And how about your mother? Was she upset? Yes. See, his mother was upset. So we now know 50% of all mothers
are upset. It's a short show, it's an hour-long show. Let's get to the topic.
I'm sorry. Yeah, okay. Well, you know, we always talk, if you crack your knuckles, you'll get big knuckles. What's wrong with big knuckles? You know, I mean, what's wrong?
You don't want to have deformed hands.
They didn't say deformed. They said big.
Well,
then you'd
big would be
then
deforming
you'd,
your hands.
If you were a guy, you'd look like a man, like you were, you know, you were a boxer. You had big knuckles. Well, the question has been on everyone's mind, what causes it? Now, for years we thought they were caused by a bubble that broke.
What do you mean what do you mean causes
within,
it?
The knuckle, there is a joint.
Yeah.
And within that joint, there is gas and fluid. And the theory has been when you crack the knuckle, mm-hmm. then you increase the pressure in the joint, and there is a gas that comes to the top of the joint. This has been since the 1940s.
And that's what the noise is?
No, it turns out they were wrong.
Oh.
That's not what it is. It turns out that it's when you're cracking your knuckle, there is a joint separation between the finger and the metacarpal. So there's a joint. That joint creates a vacuum, and it's that vacuum that is a gas-filled cavity that is actually making the sound in the synovial fluid. The synovial fluid is a fluid in there because you're making a vacuum. So the joint cracking is actually the sound of a vacuum forming within the joint. It's a vacuum. It's a sound of a vacuum, like a vacuum cleaner. Think of it as a vacuum cleaner, but it's not. But it is the sound of a vacuum forming suddenly within the joint.
Huh.
They did MRI tests. They had a guy who could crack his knuckles at the, you know, every single knuckle in his body, looked at it, and they found that's what the case was.
Hard for me to understand a vacuum making a sound.
Well, it does. I just said no, like a parent. It does. Hard for you to imagine, but that's the reality under the MRI scan. Live with it. That's what I say. So are you going to start cracking your joints?
No.
No. But this is important because it actually has an implication for chiropractic. It's not just the hands. Chiropractors are known to crack joints. And what they're actually doing is forming vacuums within the joint. And the question is this bad for the joint? And the answer is no, it is not bad for the joint. And according to chiropractic theory, it actually is good for some joints.
Yeah.
And it may indeed be good to have these vacuum pockets that form within the joint.
So ignore your mom. Crack your knuckles.
That's right. Ignore your mom, not enjoy your mom. Ignore your mom, crack your knuckles. But if your mom doesn't like you cracking your knuckles, enjoy her smile when you do it.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. And before we take a break, Sorba, on we go to our newest segment, Quacking Up with Dr. Zorba.
Quack it up with Dr. Zorba.
Okay, Zorba, here's something to think about next time you're eating Kellogg's cornflakes. Tell us about John Harvey Kellogg.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful guy. By the way, he was admired and revered by a lot of people. People like Amelia Earhart went to see him, George Bernard Shaw, Henry Ford, Thomas Edison, they went there. He, by the way, was a proponent of a number of good things. He was a proponent of, for instance, peanut butter, which he developed. He developed peanut butter. It wasn't Mr. Skippy or Happy Jif. It was actually Kellogg granola and, of course, ubiquitous cornflakes, which are not as good as some of the others. He thought smoking was bad. He thought it caused lung cancer. He was correct. But he really thought the bowel was the most important thing. In fact, he thought 90% of all illness was basically from the bowel. He thought heart attacks and cancer and stroke and depression and hysteria and gallbladder disease, they were all caused by the bowel. He thought the bowel was a sewer of auto intoxication.
And he suggested we do things about it.
Well, he did. He was big on enemas. He was very big on enemas. And he had a contraption that would throw 15 gallons of water through your bowel in just a few seconds. Can you imagine what that was like?
Pumped 15 gallons?
It was a power enema. That's right. All of a sudden, you'd be contracted to his machine. He would give
Good
you
grief.
A power enema. Good grief is right. And let me tell you, the explosion after the power enema, but people came. They came to see him. They came to have their bowels cleansed by Kellogg, and then it was a spa. He made lots of money. This was in Battle Creek. So after they had the explosion of the enema, they would lay out in Battle Creek, Michigan, which was not what you call, it's not exactly Fort Lauderdale or Mexico. And they would sit out then on chaise lounges around the pool in the summer. And they would do it also in the winter after they would have their enemas and recuperate. That's what they would do. And he thought this was a medical revolution. Now, the other thing that he also put in your bowels was yogurt. He would have you take yogurt, and then he would have you have a yogurt enema to repopulate your bowel with good bacteria. Now, he had something with that because yogurt contains lactobacillus, and that was important. But you can have yogurt. I love yogurt, and I love eating yogurt, but I don't think I'm going to have a yogurt-filled enema. No kidding is right.
Well, they discovered, obviously, at some point this all was nonsense.
Well, I mean, you know, it fell away with all quackery.
Yeah.
By the way, there were other things he was opposed of that finally put an end to the Battle Creek Spa.
Which
he was opposed to sexual activity from masturbation to intercourse. He was against that. And that's what finally sunk him.
What did he think happened if you...
He thought it was bad. He thought that it got rid of precious bodily fluids that you should keep in your body. And every time you orgasmed, that you took away a little bit of life. And that basically did him in. He was anti-sex of all forms. Be pristine. Don't engage in it. He was kind of a shaker in that way.
A little hard to double blind that. The theory.
A little hard to double blind that theory.
That
and so you know what that means? That goes the way of quackery.
Do you have an example of medical quackery to contribute to this new segment? Just send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org. Don't forget, you can find us on Facebook and iTweet.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. We have more of your questions coming up. We have our medical mythbusters, some more of your emails. Lots of good reasons for you to stay with us here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Again, 800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. But Zorba, before our next call, crispy sesame pork.
Absolutely delicious dish. And by the way, we'll talk about what you could substitute in there that makes it a really good dish as we do it. Do you like pork?
Yes.
You like crisp?
Yeah.
You like sesame?
Sure.
You'll like this dish.
Good. Let's do it.
Okay. Start out with 3 tablespoonfuls of low-sodium soy sauce.
3 big tea low-sodium soy sauce.
Yeah, which really is good. And if you want regular soy sauce, it would be okay. But frankly, we've got to get some salt out of our bloodstream, if you will.
Yeah.
2 tablespoonfuls of brown sugar.
2 big tea brown sugar.
1/3 cup of panko breadcrumbs.
1/3 cup of panko breadcrumbs,
now, do you know
whatever that is.
I was going to say, do you know what that is? Okay. Do you like Japanese food?
Sure.
Have you had tempura? Yeah.
Shrimp
tempura?
Oh, yeah, of course.
That's made with panko. Panko is it's a different type of a breadcrumb. I have no idea how it's actually manufactured. If anyone knows, please let me know.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, it is a bigger breadcrumb. It's not as fine as a breadcrumb.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I use for breadcrumbs these days. And so panko breadcrumbs are what you would use in this. Mm-hmm. 1/3 cup.
Okay. And?
Did I explain? I explained that well enough.
Yes,
okay, so
sure.
A couple tablespoonfuls of sesame seeds.
2 big tea sesame seeds.
1 egg.
1 egg.
Okay. Now, 4 thin boneless pork chops.
4 thin boneless pork chops.
That's right. So you're going to do things with these pork chops. Now, this is what you could do if you don't want to have pork chops. You could use tempeh. Do you know what tempeh is?
No.
Caught you.
I've heard the word.
Caught you. Okay, tempeh. Well, it's a place in Arizona. Ha-ha.
I know that part. Yeah.
It is a soybean curd, tofu, your favorite food.
Yeah.
We haven't talked about tofu in a while.
That's
why not?
All right. That's all right.
But it's basically a tofu that has been prepared and it's not crisp, but it has a very firm taste to it. And it's made, it's kind of squashed down, and it's used in stir-fried dishes. So tempeh you could use.
Why do we want thin pork chops?
Well, because it's easier to use. It's easier to work. You'll see. I mean, if it's thick, it's not going to work as well because you're going to make it in such a way it's got to be thin. Oh. The tempeh that you buy is thin. You could also use salmon, and you could cut it in thin slices.
Okay.
We'll talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've explained it for the vegetarians and the people who only eat fish. The pescatarians or something like that. I've seen it, but I don't know what it is. Maybe somebody could let us know. I bet there's a listener out there who's going to write in or call us.
I'm sure. I'm sure.
3 tablespoonfuls of canola oil.
3 big tea canola oil.
5 ounces of salad greens.
5 ounces of salad greens.
1 cup of grape tomatoes, little tomatoes.
1 cup of grape tomatoes.
And 1 cup of shredded carrots.
1 cup of shredded carrots.
Okay, let's make it.
Okay.
In a small saucepan, whisk together the soy sauce and brown sugar, heat it to simmering and medium, just a little bit, and let it cool for about 2 minutes because you just want it to sort of connect together. Mm-hmm. Then in a medium plate, combine the panko and sesame seeds.
Sesame Street.
combine Sesame Street. You know something? It's just the way the brain works. Now I've got this.
Big Bird will love this Sesame.
I've got to tell you, but now the song is playing in my head. It's hard for me to concentrate. I mean, I've got it in my head now. I've got to push it out of my head and get to sesame seeds. So once again, in a medium plate, combine panko and sesame seeds.
Right.
Which, by the way, Big Bird loves sesame seeds.
Right.
In a shallow bowl, beat one egg, and you dip the pork chops in the egg, and then coat it in the panko mixture.
Yeah.
Now, if you're going to use salmon, you would take a little fillet of salmon and dip it in the eggs. If you're going to use a tempeh, you're going to do the same thing, dip it in the eggs, and then coat it in the panko mixture. Then in a 12-inch skillet, heat the canola oil on medium heat until hot. Fry the pork chops or, once again, salmon or panko on each side until cooked. Make sure it's cooked according to directions. For pork, it's about 150 degrees. For fish, you can look it up. Drain it on a paper towel. Cut it into cubes. Once again, cut it into cubes. And then in a large bowl, toss the salad greens, grape tomatoes, carrots, and pork or salmon or tempeh. Voila. You've got a wonderful dish. You've got a fabulous dish with sesame. You've got salad greens in there, grape tomatoes, a little crunch from the carrots. It's wonderful.
A recipe even Oscar the Grouch would love.
I love that. That's right. Now, you can find this recipe, guess where, Tom?
At you go to the computer.
That's right.
Right.
Go to the computer.
Turn it on.
That's right. Wait for 2 minutes or 3 minutes. That's ZorbaPastor.org. ZorbaPastor.org. Don't forget, you can find us on Facebook and I tweet. Follow me on Twitter.
800-462-7413, the number to call if you have a question for Zorba. And Zorba, our next caller is a listener in Billings, Montana. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, I want to thank you both for being able to get on the show. And I had a question concerning these corticosteroid injections for pain. I hear kind of conflicting opinions from others that they're damaging to tissue and muscle and tendons and whatnot. And I kind of have a benefit from them. So I didn't know how successive you can have them. In various places or in the same place.
What are you getting them for?
Well, I had a pelvis fracture about a year ago, and so I had one 6 months after that post-op, and now I'm due. Would like to have another one. And I've had lower back. I'm wanting to get one there as well. And I've had one in the shoulder and neck. And these, of course, have been over the years, but I just concerned with people telling me that the damaging effects of these.
Oh, sure.
Whether I should continue and how often. Now, doctors will say, well, you can, you know, have up to three a year. And I think they said it. And that's in the same area.
Well, first of all, steroids are what we call a double-edged sword. They really work, and they really have side effects. And what they do is they decrease inflammation in the tissue. That gets rid of pain. But when you decrease inflammation in the tissue, you also run a risk of infection. Because when you get an infection, you want inflammation to come in there, red blood cells, white blood cells, the white blood cells especially, and get rid of the infection. And steroids interfere with that ability. They also can cause a reduction in the strength of tissue. So repeated injections can cause problems. So we only do a certain number of injections in the knee because then we can cause problems with the cartilage in the knee. In the back, it can be a little different, but every time you go in the back, you run a risk of infection because there's a needle going in there. Then you're putting a steroid in there that may actually reduce the ability for the body to fight infections. So I think all the fears about steroids are very, very well-founded. On the other hand, for some people, it's the only way they can control pain. And they go, well, when I get my steroid injection, I don't have pain. It allows me to walk and do the things I want to do. And so I'm going to have repeat steroid injections when I can, you know, 2 to 4 times a year. And because then I can function and I'm willing to take the risk because it improves quality of life. That's kind of the way to think about it. They're right. When your friends say, hey, there's side effects, you may be actually ruining your body. They're right. On the other hand, the effects may be allowing you to help your body do things, and then you can do steroids. stuff you can't do, and that helps your body. And so you kind of have to balance it. How many years have you had these injections for?
Oh, probably the last 5 years.
Uh-huh.
I'm 56, so uh-huh. I'm kind of at that age where, you know, the pain is, aches and pains are kind of a part of living, I think. So I guess I've taken your advice with the Aleve, uh-huh. 2 in the morning, 2 at night.
Good, 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 good.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate that. Yeah, that's
sure.
been fairly successful. In fact, I was hoping there was something like that, you know, in a stronger form that could just sort of hit yeah. everything in the body. But
unfortunately, there isn't. There is not that. Steroids, oral steroids, will get rid of things, but they have too many side effects, so we only use them in a burst form. So I think, getting back to that injection, you weigh the pros, you make the cons, you make a decision. And that's how you do it. And there are a number of people that come in for periodic injections and do just fine. And they're willing to take that risk. You know, we all take risks in our life. We all take risks and we weigh them together. But that's where you've got to sit down, look at it, and kind of make those decisions.
Yeah, okay. Well, that gives me a lot of help on it, so I appreciate that.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. Thanks a lot. Yeah. Let us know what happens.
We appreciate that call at 800-462-7413. And now Zorba in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma is with us. Hi.
Hi there. How are you?
Fine. How can we help?
Well, I have a 10-year-old boy who has, for probably the past 2 or 3 months, been waking up periodically through the night. He's not sleeping through the night. There'll be times where he's waking up like maybe 6 times in a night. And that's not normal. So I need some help.
Uh-huh.
Because I'm not getting any sleep. He's not getting sleep. Dad's not getting sleep.
Wow. So is he waking up with terrors, night terrors?
Sometimes there are night terrors, and
uh-huh.
sometimes he's just up
uh-huh.
because he says he can't sleep.
Uh-huh. Soda. What kind of soda does he drink?
He drinks hardly any soda.
Okay,
we don't do a lot of soda in our home at all.
Good. Any other changes? Exercise, school? Is he having trouble at school?
Well, the only thing that I, and it just dawned on me, they just started standardized testing just this week, and they have been practicing for it. So
uh-huh.
it kind of dawned on me, okay, this is when all this kind of started.
Yeah, there may
a
be.
Bit.
Well, it may be from anxiety. Test calls
yeah.
anxiety. I mean, I have to take tests for family medicine once every 7 to 10 years, and when I'm sitting in the test, I have the same anxiety I did when I was 15 in high school. It makes no difference. It's like boing, there it
yeah.
is. And so the anxiety is probably a major part of this issue. Where does he sleep? Sleeps in another bed.
He sleeps in his own room, and
uh-huh.
and he shares a room with his brother, who is
uh-huh.
11,
mm-hmm.
but he has his own bed.
Uh-huh. So one way that you can often treat anxiety like this for a while is you talk with him and you say, look, if you're anxious, we're going to set up a little bed on the floor, pillow on the floor, a pillow and a blanket and something else. Say, if you're anxious in the middle of the night, don't wake us up. Come into the room and you can sleep with us. And that often is enough so that kids eventually stop doing it. But he may wake up, he's got anxiety, he doesn't know what's going on, he's got night terrors, he's got a nightmare, and he just wants to be soothed, and he doesn't have to wake you up, he just has to be in your presence.
Right.
And that might be enough. But he goes to sleep in his other room. He doesn't go to sleep in the room with you. But if he wakes up in the night, he can come into your room, not into your bed. I wouldn't disturb your sleep. Quietly in your room and see how that works. That can be extremely effective. And if you find him in the room, then you talk to him. You know, you say, what were you anxious about? Do you really know? And if you talk to him every time you find him in your room, he may eventually begin to talk about what's making him anxious, because it's probably the test taking. And we all have to take tests sooner or later.
Right.
I mean, we don't want to sanitize our children's experiences so they don't have to take tests, because then they don't learn how to deal with situations that make them anxious, which is part of life. So I'm not against tests at all, but we have to learn how to handle the anxiety of tests.
Okay. I can try that, because I haven't, you know, in the middle of the night, I'm just like, oh, you know, I'm just like,
right.
you know, I just want to get it over because I'm so exhausted. But I've never really taken time out at that moment to say what's going on. And he did, you know, he told me one time he woke up at 1 a.m. just to make sure he wasn't late for school.
Yeah.
Because he didn't want to be late. So I know that's what it is, he's anxious about
you something. See, that's the anxiety. And so in the morning you say, hey, came in the room, what made you anxious? But then he's got a safe place. Your room and your bedroom is safe. The 11-year-old, right. He knows, is an 11-year-old. But mom and dad right. know what's going on.
Right. Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I am definitely going to try that tonight.
Oh, excellent. Good. You're welcome. Thanks. Let us know what happens.
Thanks so much for the call. And before we take a quick break, Zorba, here's a question from a listener named Dunnan. He writes, Dear Dr. Pastor, I've been seeing a dermatologist for a scalp condition where I get very itchy and almost painful pustules. I've tried different shampoos, but nothing works. The doctor has me on an antibiotic, but I'm concerned about using these all the time, and they don't rid me of the condition entirely. When I tell the dermatologist this, she only says to take more of the antibiotic. I'm told it's from stress, but little relieves it, and it's quite uncomfortable. Is there anything else you can suggest?
Well, first of all, I don't think pustules in your head are from stress. I mean, I'm on the record with that.
Yeah.
Stress may make it worse, or you may itch, and that may cause it. But, I mean, when I see pustules, first thing, I don't think of as stress. I think of as infection. But sometimes skin infections can be very hard to get rid of. Mm-hmm. And sometimes what you need is 30, 60, or 90 days of an antibiotic, such as doxycycline or minocycline, and that will get it under control. The other thing that might be useful is Selsun Blue. I love it. It's over-the-counter. Put it on your scalp for 5 minutes. Put on a shower cap so it doesn't wash off, mm-hmm. and do that for 5 minutes every single day. And sometimes Selsun Blue does amazing things to the scalp. And sometimes, if that doesn't work, I'd look towards a steroid. That's a prescription steroid lotion that you put in the scalp. But this is something you can work on. Like I said, you need to have more antibiotics versus less for a longer period of time, and that might do the trick.
Mm-hmm. If you have a question for Zorba, maybe a real head scratcher, just send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org or post it on Facebook.
Some interesting research coming up. We'll talk about that. More of your calls, our medical myth buster too. Right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. 800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. But right now, Zorba, we talk once again about aspirin.
Yes. So aspirin, which is a great drug, as we know, reduces the risk of heart attack, a stroke. It has side effects of GI bleeding, and also you may not clot if you hit your head. So, I mean, you know, you may have a hemorrhagic stroke, but the risk of a thrombotic stroke, the more common one, is much less. And it looks like aspirin reduces the risk of colon cancer and other cancers of the GI tract.
Ooh, how so?
Well, let's talk about it. It turns out we've known for many years, and I've talked about it for many years, that aspirin reduces colon polyps by about 50%. And we know that some colon polyps are more likely to become cancerous. And the question all along has been, does cancer get reduced by aspirin, even though it reduces colon polyps? And this study that recently came out of Harvard, the Harvard School of Public Health, showed there's a 20%, that is a lot, reduction of cancers of the GI tract, colon cancer, rectal cancer, esophageal cancer, by people who take aspirin on a regular basis.
How did they do this study?
82,000 women in the nurses' health study, 48,000 men in the physicians' health study, started in 1986, looked at data on aspirin use. And they did that on a regular basis. They said, how many aspirin tablets do you take a week? Now, the study is important because they're doctors and nurses who are usually, and I say usually, likely to keep track of the meds they take and when they take it. And they've been following them for more than 30 years. After that time, they looked at women, men and women, who took a regular dose of aspirin, 325 milligrams, regular aspirin tablet, two times a week or more, had a 20% lower risk of getting colon, rectal, and esophageal cancer than men and women who rarely took an aspirin tablet at all. Major difference.
What does that mean? To those of us who take these low-dose aspirin?
Well, that's a good question. You know, and we don't have the answer to that, because they looked at regular aspirin. They found the correlation with regular aspirin. And they found the correlation was after you took it for about 10 to 15 years. I mean, in other words, you had to be taking it for a long time. And it disappeared if you stopped taking aspirin after about 3 or 4 years. But I think it means that we should start looking at taking a regular aspirin tablet at least twice a week, or maybe every single day. Because, I mean, if I'm going to take aspirin, I want to reduce the risk of colon cancer and the risk of having a heart attack.
So if I should stop taking the low dose?
Well, I think this shows that at least twice a week you should take a regular aspirin tablet. For some people, it'll be easier to put a regular aspirin tablet and take it every single day. But I find this actually monumentally good information, that there may be a way to prevent colon cancer, and that's by taking aspirin.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And Zorba, our next caller is a listener in El Paso, Texas. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Dr. Z.
How can we help?
I recently went to a local clinic here where I live in El Paso and for an HIV test, and it came back negative. And they recommended to me that I might want to try a prescription drug called PrEP. I think it stands for pre-exposure prophylaxis. And I just wanted to know how that drug works. I understand what it does, but I just wanted to know how it works, mm-hmm. and if there are any side effects for PrEP, because I didn't hear about it up until they told me about it at the clinic.
Oh, sure. So let's go back to why you went to the clinic. You went to the clinic because you had unprotected sex, and I assume you were worried about having HIV?
No, I just go for regular testing. I go at least twice a year, and I do practice safe sex. It's just they come to recognize my face and thought that I might be interested in the prophylaxis.
Well, the prophylaxis is really when you're at risk for getting HIV. And it's basically an HIV drug. It's an antiviral drug that has been shown to be really quite effective in preventing HIV. And I can't remember the exact numbers, but it's way up there in the prevention. And the issue has been whether or not this should be widely available. And frankly, one of the issues is whether or not it should be available without a prescription so that people can actually get it. It's an antiviral. So if you look up what it is, you'll look at the effects and the side effects. It's a very well-tolerated drug that can be useful. But like you said, all drugs, just like antibiotics, have effects and side effects. But the underlying issue that I think is very important to address is what's your risk for getting HIV. And what you want to do is you want to reduce that risk. And one of the reasons that this drug and other drugs have not become widely, we'll say, advertised and available is that HIV researchers, rightfully say, and public health people, is that we should prevent the spread of HIV by doing safe sex practices. And so if you're engaged in any activity where you're worried about getting HIV, you want to change that activity. And I'd look at that as really the most important thing you can do. And I would look at that, before I would look at this. Once again, I think it's a well-tolerated drug, and it's one of the drugs that people use if they've engaged in, an unsafe sex and they're worried about it. I think it should be used. I think it's worthwhile.
Thank you, Doctor.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Hope that was helpful.
Mm-hmm. And time now, Zorba, for our medical MythBuster. Today's question is from a loyal listener, Peter from Logan, Utah. He writes, "Dear Dr. Zorba, first off, I love the show. You and Tom are addictive in a good way. My question..."
Addictive?
Yeah. "My question, I read that being underweight in middle age, a BMI less than 20, increases the risk of developing dementia by about a third.
Oh, gosh.
Compared to people of the same age who are of a normal weight.
Uh-huh.
What's your opinion? Is this a myth, or could gaining weight actually improve some people's health?"
Well, first of all, gaining weight, being, you know, the ideal BMI weight, if we're going to put up a flag, is between 20 and 25, but there's no absolute there. There's some people who are just thin and are quite healthy, but thinness is not associated with dementia. I disagree. It is a myth. Thin people do not become demented. Thin people are thin. That's about all that there is. And whether or not you're too thin for your body, you know, clearly there's one end. People who are anorexic and they're too thin and it's not healthy, mm-hmm. just like people who are obese. But it's really a broad spectrum. And some people are, if you will, born thinner than others and have a predisposition to thinness and they're healthy. Is there anyone you can think of who is a thin person who is healthy? You're healthy.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I may be making a case for our letter writer here.
Are you becoming demented?
I think I'm every now and then.
That's right.
Every now and
losing
then.
A syllable here and there.
Indeed. Have a myth you'd like Zorba to weigh in on? Just send an email at
Zorba@WPR.org or post it on Facebook.
Want to talk with Zorba? 800-462-7413, the number to call. And, Zorba, we have a listener with us now in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Dr. Zorba. Mm-hmm. I was at my GP a few days ago getting my annual physical, and I was dreading the digital prostate exam, and then he said they no longer do this, mm-hmm. and nor do they do PSA tests on asymptomatic men. So this surprised me a lot. I'm wondering what you think about that. I'm wondering if there's another test that that should be done in place of this. And then I guess most importantly is what exactly are the symptoms that would cause one to be concerned?
Oh, sure. You know, I haven't had anyone walk into my office and say, gee, can you please do a rectal examination on me? I'd like to have it done. So dreading it is actually a very common, you know, is a very common thing. The feds have given prostate cancer testing a flunking grade. They have said we do more harm than good, that we're crying fire where fire isn't there, that 15 years out, there is no difference in the death rate, the crude death rate, between those men who have been screened for prostate cancer and those who have not. Now, it's true that, from what I can gather, that there is a drop in the prostate cancer rate from men who have been screened, but it's also true that those men are more likely to die of something else. In other words, that the death rate is no different. And so a lot of us have stopped screening for it. I am one of those people. So the digital rectal examination was never very accurate. If you feel a stone in there, the normal consistency of a prostate, if you've never done a rectal examination, as most of our listeners have not, it feels like the end of the nose. Push on the end of your nose. Go ahead, Tom. Push on the end of your nose.
Right.
What's it feel like?
I don't know.
Feels like a prostate. That's what it feels like.
But I know
that's
that.
How you wouldn't, you see. I'm just teaching you. The end of your nose feels like a prostate. You can go home to Monica and say, Monica, this is what my prostate feels like, the end of my nose.
Whatever.
And then if there's if it feels like there's a stone in there, that can imply that there's cancer. It's a poor screening examination, it's not very accurate. Mm-hmm. The PSA test picks up lots of things that are not cancer. So, well, is it good because it picks up cancer? Well, roughly 40% of all cancer, the PSA is normal. 40% of all elevated PSAs, there's no cancer at all. Now, if you find cancer, most of it doesn't grow. It's just in there, indolent, doesn't do a thing. And so that's why we don't screen for it. Now, what are the symptoms? Well, if you've got symptoms like blood in the urine or an increase in urinary stream that you're concerned about that suddenly happens, you know, then we screen for it. I also screen for it. I mention it to guys, and if they go, I want to have it screened, I often will do a PSA test. Mm-hmm. And the reason is they want to have it done. I talk to them about it, and if they still want to have it done, I'll say, I'll do it. Your insurance will cover it. And then I'll tell them, I don't think it's a good idea. So let me give you an example. Mm-hmm. I gave this discussion to a guy, and he said, I want to have it done anyway, and his PSA was elevated. And I said, well, you have to go to the urologist to talk about it. You need a biopsy, and you may need surgery. And he said, well, you told me that it doesn't do any good. And I said, you're right. But once you have a positive test, I have to, as a doctor, give you the referral. Yeah. Whether you go there or not is your business. So he ultimately went there. The prostate was positive. He ultimately had his prostate removed. It had a minimal cancer in. He now has erectile dysfunction and dribbling.
Oh, gee.
And yeah. He's 57 years old.
Oh.
So the reality is maybe we didn't save his life because the amount of prostate cancer in there was minimal, but it was positive. He now has the side effects of the surgery. I didn't want to do the test in the first place. That's my position. A number of urologists may disagree with my position. I just want to mention that up front.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. I've said for the last two decades, the PSA test is the most controversial test in medicine, and it still remains that.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. And before we head out today, Zorba, let's read an email from a listener named Connie about her experience with an EpiPen. She writes, "Please do let people know of the dangers of the EpiPen. I was given one after I had anaphylaxis as a reaction to seafood. I used it at an international picnic when I realized there was seafood in a salad I'd eaten. It turned out that the monster was not the seafood, but the metabisulfite preservative used to keep fish fresh in shipping. Even worse, an EpiPen contains the very same preservative to protect the contents that were supposed to save me from anaphylaxis. So I got a double dose and barely made it to the ER. So please let people know of this life-threatening danger."
Well, EpiPens save lives. There's undoubtedly no doubt about it. They save lives. And they're a very good thing for people who have anaphylaxis to something like seafood. Now, whether or not the preservative is actually causing her a problem, I think that remains to be seen. I'm skeptical of that. Mm. I have never heard of what is used, which is adrenaline, in the EpiPen actually causing a problem. Now, the EpiPen doesn't always work. So she may have been allergic to seafood and had an EpiPen, and then it didn't work because she got a dose of seafood and she ended up having to go to the ER. Because in the emergency room, sometimes we have to give two or three doses of adrenaline in order to get the person better. So I'm skeptical that the preservative caused it. However, she needs to see an allergist and make sure she finds out what she's really allergic to. It may not be the preservative in seafood. It may be the seafood.
But don't blame the EpiPen.
I would not blame the EpiPen. I think EpiPens save lives. They're great. They're absolutely monumentally great for people who have allergies and serious allergic responses.
Have a question for Zorba? Just send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org. And don't forget, you can post it on Facebook, and I tweet at Dr. Zorba.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom. Tweet, tweet.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at zorbapastor.org.
Don't forget you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen, and our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll join us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0502Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at zorbapastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.